Good evening, everyone. I think I'll get tonight's proceedings underway. Firstly, welcome. Thanks very much for coming. It's really encouraging to see so many of you come out this evening. The idea behind tonight's event is a networking evening, primarily, and we wanted to do something on the subject of hedging in the context of pension funds. And it was John and Ian who came up with a very useful suggestion of focusing on the difficulty of earning LIBOR returns. Now, I must confess that when they made the suggestion, I was a little bit sceptical at first. I thought, well, surely there must be a lot more urgent and pressing risk issues for actuaries and other professionals out there in relation to pension funds. But they very carefully explained to me that the world was changing and that risks that were once not terribly important suddenly are coming to the fore as the context of pension funds and other institutions starts to change. So we're very very grateful to them for the idea. This event is organised really by the Finance Investment Risk Management Board, now operating as two separate entities in the new organisation of the Institute. But we very much hope this this activity and these themes will continue to be developed, and we hope that you'll help to contribute to shaping the agenda, you know, through the networking that we have afterwards. So the background to the subject, it is about difficulty of earning LIBOR, it is in the context of pension scheme risk, and Ian and John are going to talk about a case study that they've worked on where these issues became very live and very important and had to be dealt with. But at the same time, we think that it's not something that's unique to a pension fund setting, and this may be a subject that's of interest to lots of actuaries and other finance professionals. So if you're a pensions actuary, LDI principles may well lead you to some of the logic that we'll be discussing this evening. If you're a life insurance professional or actuary, dealing with things like risk-based capital, risk measurement, risk budgeting, we think some of the principles that we'll be discussing this evening will be of interest. And even for general insurance actuaries like myself, there are some common themes here. I mean, as a GI actuary, you don't normally spend much time thinking about asset risk in a long career. You can probably count the amount of time you think about LIBOR returns on a couple of in terms of days. But I guess that was the way the world used to be, and things have changed very much now, and all of a sudden people are conscious that LIBOR returns aren't to be taken for granted. So hopefully what we have here today is an interesting discussion about the topic. It's going to be covered from different perspectives. Ian very much is going to bring us the pension trustee perspective. John's going to be talking a little bit more from the investment advisor and the investment actuary's perspective. So that's really the subject. I'd like to introduce you then to Ian and to John. Ian Mabry is a director at Citi, where he's head of insurance actuarial, and Ian works in the insurance and pensions structured solutions part of the bank. Ian's currently a trustee of two pension schemes, a TRN pension scheme, and one of Citi's own main defined benefit pension schemes. Ian heads up the insurance actuarial part of IPSS, and he's got extensive experience in regulatory and risk-based capital for pension schemes. He's also spent a lot of time looking at insurance companies and aspects of Solvency II, IFRS, and pension reform as well. Since joining Citi, Ian's done quite a lot of work on insurance and pension fund clients in the UK, continental Europe, US and Australia. Prior to joining Citi, Ian worked for a UK insurance company in various senior management positions. And as I mentioned earlier, Ian is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries. John Mannion, a colleague of mine, is a principal at Towers Perrin, where he heads the retirement risk solutions business in Europe. John advises on all aspects of international benefits and pensions, with a particular focus on transactions that reduce cost and risk. He's worked in a variety of contexts, including private equity, joint ventures, privatisations, IPOs. John's clients consist of major global companies and specialist leaders in their field. John is also a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries, but a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia as well. So the order of play for this evening, we've got about an hour really to get through the presented material. It's going to be presented in a couple of stages, so Ian and John are going to be interchanging a little bit, and we'd very much like your involvement. And so what we'll be doing is stopping at the end of each stage and giving the opportunity to ask any questions. There will be an opportunity for any catch-up questions at the end. And just some general housekeeping. There are no fire alarms planned for this evening, so if you hear the fire alarm, get out. There will be a roving mic for anybody who wants to ask questions, and you may well see some hard copies of the slides that we're about to present. And finally, there'll be wine and canapés afterwards. Those are not just an inducement to get you to stay to the end, but an opportunity to interact and to perhaps to contribute some other ideas and themes that we could talk about in the future. So with all that said and done, I'd just like to invite Ian really to introduce this subject to begin to.
Thank you, Cormac. Good evening, everybody. Just to outline what we're going to cover, I'll briefly set up the background to the case study that we're basing the analysis on. Once I've done that, John will then pick up some of the particular market-related issues. I'll then come back and talk a little bit about how we've incorporated those market issues into the case study, and then between us we'll draw some conclusions for the trustees of the scheme, but also for the industry as a whole and for the actuarial profession. I would emphasise I'm taking the position of the trustee of this scheme. It is based on the Thompson Regional Newspaper Scheme that City acquired last summer, and of which I became one of the employer-nominated trustees of in the autumn. However, we have taken that as the outline for the case study, but the analyses that have done, we have made some changes to make it specific for this evening, although I would confirm that the results that we're drawing are consistent with those for the underlying case study. So, Thompson Regional Newspapers, as I mentioned, acquired by City, with City acting as the sponsor, was a very mature scheme. It had something in the region of 75% of the members as pensioners, and the remaining members being deferred. So no active members, and therefore no future accrual of benefits. Therefore, it fits into the natural range of schemes that potentially would be looking to consider buyout. Now, from the trustees' perspective, they had a number of particular issues to focus on. Effectively, they're an orphan scheme. The companies that were the active companies in terms of the sponsorship of the scheme had been sold by the Thompson Group some 10 years earlier. As a result of that, the members had a very close affinity with the pension scheme, and I'd also say with the member-nominated trustees who had been on the board for a considerable period of time and had a very good and ongoing relationship with significant numbers of the members. Now, having sold the companies 10 years ago, the pension plan was retained. It was a pretty well-funded scheme. Had a traditional exposure to assets in terms of equities and a long bond portfolio. With the backing of the Thompson Group overall, it had a reasonably good sponsor covenant. However, it was clear that from the company's perspective and also from the trustees, they were looking for an exit route. And the ideal circumstances they were looking for would have been an exit route with no additional contributions from the company. over a period of years, that had been looked at in terms of establishing the buyout cost, and although as a well-funded scheme, it wasn't able to reach that buyout level. As a result of discussions with Citi, we identified the corporate buyout route, for want of a better term, or what we call adoption, to enable the scheme to be taken off of Thompson's balance sheet effectively and move to Citi as the sponsoring entity, with the aim of running off and ultimately buying it out. Now, prior to that, the trustees had already taken a number of initiatives on risk management. In particular, they had purchased a bulk annuity policy as an investment of the scheme to cover a significant proportion of the members. So something in the region of half of the assets were effectively in the form of this insurance policy. So we find ourselves in a position, a quite fortunate position, where there was close alignment between the requirements from both the trustees and the sponsors. And that was to minimise risk. Now, I've already talked about the purchase of the bulk annuity. There are actually a number of steps that had been taken by the scheme over a number of years to remove risk. And I just want to go through that risk management progression to set the scene for the work that John's going to talk about. So at the turn of the century, or thereabouts, the scheme, as I said, fairly traditional asset mix, 25% in equities and 75% in long bonds, reflecting the relatively mature nature of the scheme. And it's probably fair to say that the scheme with that sort of distribution of memberships might be considered to be at sort of one extreme of the current profile of pensions. Having said that, it's probably a route that the industry as a whole is moving towards as a result of scheme closures, as a result of companies reorganising, layoffs in certain industries. So it's by no means a unique example, but it is something that we believe a significant number of schemes are likely to face in the coming years. So they had the purchase of the bulk annuity policy. In 2007, prior to proceeding with the transaction with Citi, the equities were sold, and then finally following the acquisition, an LDI-type strategy was implemented, although in what I would describe as a disaggregated form with a separate LIBOR manager and a swaps execution program. So, given that risk management progression, the real challenge for the trustees is their obligation now is to deliver LIBOR. But just to set the scene as to what those LIBOR risks are, let's work through a high-level view of the risks of the scheme. Just to explain the graphs that we're seeing on the next two or three pages and subsequently in the presentation, we have effectively the component analysis of a value at risk. So looking at the individual undiversified components of equities, interest rates and inflation being the primary risks that are in the scheme. The fact that those benefits are then diversified, giving you a total market risk exposure, and then the demographic risks on top of that. Those demographic risks, primarily longevity, but including a range of options that were still available to members, in particular early retirement options and the mix between tax-free lump sum and pension. So all of those demographics were stress tested rather than run through a stochastic simulation which has produced the market risk. Now, the total numbers in each bar reflect the risk of the scheme before it bought the bulk annuity policy. So the total market risk of the order of £18 million in a scheme that had total liabilities of something of the order of £200 million, with individual components broadly split between equities, interest rates and inflation. Not that unusual, you'd probably say, perhaps equities being that bit lower because of the smaller allocation than the industry as a whole. The yellow components then show the amount of risk that has been removed as a result of purchasing the bulk annuity. So you see roughly a removal of 50% of the equities because 50% of the assets were sold to purchase the annuity, something less than 50% of the risk removed from interest rates and inflation and the demographics, because on average the pensioner population that the bulk annuity is covering will have significantly shorter duration than the liabilities overall. But that bulk annuity policy has removed something like 30 to 40% of the overall risk. The second stage in the analysis, in the risk management process, was to remove equities. And this really was a precursor to the acquisition by Citi. The aim really being to lock down the price at which the transaction could take place, principally because the existence of the equities, either the risk had to be removed through hedging or the equities needed to be sold. The decision of the trustees ultimately was to remove the equities from the portfolio. So clearly that eliminates the equity risk from the analysis and substantially reduces the interest rate and inflation risk, because the bond portfolio was shifted into very long-dated index-linked gilts and therefore removed a substantial amount of those residual risks. The total risk clearly has been significantly reduced, although the overall impact has been offset to some degree by a significant loss of the diversification benefit. The overall result now is that clearly the demographic risks dominate in terms of the total risks of the portfolio. The final step on the de-risking was to replace the index-linked bond portfolio and cash with a better mitigant of the risks in terms of a series of inflation and interest rate swaps. And clearly, as you can see, that has now reduced the total market risk to 0.7, and now the demographic risks dominate completely. But we've effectively taken out something like 95% of the total market risk through this series of three transactions, and a proportion of the demographic risks from the initial purchase of the bulk annuity. So in terms of de-risking the scheme, having removed 95% of the risk, I think it's fair to say that the trustees were broadly comfortable that they'd achieved their objectives. And also from the new sponsor's perspective, Citi, they were also very happy that the risks that effectively appear in their risk-based capital had also been significantly removed. Although I would say that the analysis here has been shown in terms of 95% value at risk. For the bank as a whole, we're clearly looking at far higher levels of confidence interval, so typically looking at 99.5 and even 99.95 for an economic capital perspective. And in those situations, the reduction of risk is even greater than it is here. Now, that's the first part of the presentation, setting the scene in terms of the case study. Want to take a short pause there. Firstly, just to make sure that we have explained sufficiently the context, and just to see whether there are any questions before we move on to the next section, where John will talk about generating libel.
Yeah, could you just explain the remaining 0.7 market risk, where that risk is coming from? Is there some kind of assumption that the swaps aren't a perfect hedge for the cash flows?
Yeah, the transaction that was put in place to remove the risk, the trustees, in conjunction with advice from the investment consultant and discussion with the counterparty, take the view that the cash flows are not known with certainty. primarily because of the demographic risks, particularly hedging a full series of cash flows where there is potential for a shift of those cash flows in terms of early retirement decisions and also in terms of the split between cash flows and pensions, meant that we took a step back from a full cash flow hedge to look at executing a relatively small number of swaps that effectively remove the principal part of the risk across 5-year age bands, or 5-year calendar year bands for retirement. So that leaves a small amount of risk against the curve that isn't fully removed.
Ian, could I just clarify, when you do refer to VAR, you're talking about, is it 1-year VAR you're looking at?
Yes, it's 1-year VAR.
On the 95% also.
Correct.
And it's an interesting series of slides. Just for clarification also, on the first slide, just taking equity as an example, you illustrate through the bulk annuity, reducing, I guess, the equity VAR from 11.5 million down to 5.3, is that correct?
Correct.
But when you then move to the second slide, looking at the equity sale, the equity VAR there starts at 10
yeah,
point...
The analyses aren't contemporaneous,
is
a period of time between the analyses, so I'm not replicating the changes occurring at a point in time, so the risk had actually changed between the two events.
Right, okay.
Primarily as a result of movements in underlying market variables.
Okay, understood. Well, that clarifies that. Thank you.
Presumably, there were transaction costs in moving from, say, a bond portfolio to a swaps portfolio. And how would that compare to the reduction in market risk achieved?
To be honest, the transaction costs are, they're not immaterial, but compared to the risk reduction, they are relatively small. The specific circumstances of this scheme is relatively unusual in the sense that you have a counterparty that is the same counterparty as the sponsor, and therefore there is a circularity of credit exposure that you can argue, and therefore that helps to mitigate some of the market impact costs in terms of the pricing that was provided to the trustees. But yes, there are some frictional costs associated with these transactions, and John will cover some of that in relation to the LIBOR fund in general, but it's very true, there are frictional costs associated with the swaps.
Okay, thanks.
On that note, I will pass over to John.
Well, good evening, everyone. Turning on a slightly different track, what we're going to do... Sorry, first find the right page. Is just have a little bit of background, and for some people who know this very well, I apologise for the next couple of minutes, but I think it's important just to step through some of the background for everyone in the audience. When you execute some of these contracts, there are particular rates that you refer to, there are particular instruments that are used, and there's some excellent background on those that's available in either academic papers or the relevant websites of the Bankers Association or the Wholesale Market Brokers Association, the Bank of England, the Debt Management Office, and so on. So, you know, for further kind of consideration of this at a high level, there's plenty of information and explains exactly over the periods of time how the rates are determined and so on. But I just wanted to do just a snapshot up front of that. The first one is kind of LIBOR, and we talked about LIBOR, but LIBOR is set for the UK by a panel of 16 banks. And what tends to happen is that with that panel of 16 banks, they have a particular perspective on the market, particular issues that they deal with in the market, but there's other financial institutions who are involved in the market. So you do get some setting of the underlying rates that will vary depending on the market conditions affecting that panel. The next one is the bid rate. Now, this is an offer rate LIBOR. So that's what they say, look, we're going to lend to you at this rate if you want to take some money. But if you turn around the other way and say, I want to lend you some money, you have a broker in the middle or a dealer in the middle, and there's a spread. So you don't necessarily get the same as the offer rate when you want to deposit money. Now, typically, LIBOR is set through that panel process of the 16 banks, and it's set for 1 week, 2 weeks, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, and so on a daily basis. But there's a lot of money that's dealt with overnight as well. And that's typically done through what's called, typically eight organizations probably dominate the market there, but a couple do more than others. And they act as intermediaries between the banks for overnight funds. And those wholesale brokers effectively have an offer rate that they are surveyed on to determine what their average overnight rate is. And that sets something called SONIA. Now, in a lot of banking, what's happened is the banks have become a bit more efficient. They don't necessarily look out and borrow for 90 days or 30 days or so on. They often deal with things that are overnight but roll over automatically night by night by night. So you sometimes have things called overnight indexed swaps, which are kind of compounded these daily rates. So there's these various kind of things that are happening in the banking sector that set the terms that typically underlie a lot of these contracts because they're the reference rates that are used. The other one that we kind of talk about, and we really talk about as a reference point for very high level, high level security of deposit, is using repurchase agreements. Now, a repurchase agreement's effectively a fancy way to borrow some money off someone, but give them some pretty good collateral for it, so you get a low borrowing rate. So if I own a security, say a government security, I take that along to someone else and I say, look, I want you to lend me some money for 5 days. And I've got this government security to prove that I'm good for the funds. I hand them the security, agree the rate that I'm really borrowing off them and the amount of money I'm effectively borrowing for that period. And then 5 days later, I have an agreement that they'll sell it back to me at the price we agreed, which kind of sets the rate that I've paid them for the borrowing. Now, the reason you do that is that you actually sell it to them and then take it back, is if there was a dispute, they already own the security. So if you're not in a position to hand back the money and buy it back, they're actually holding the security rather than a legal issue of trying to get the money out of someone and so on. So it just makes it very simple in that market if there was a default. Now, as I said, there's some kind of very good background sources, and it's quite important when you get into the detail, and as I step through some of the stuff, I'll mention that what I've got up there is misleading or doesn't really make sense in the way it's presented, because you have to be comparing apples and apples. I've done it fairly simplistically to take you through the steps, but, you know, for example, sterling might be quoted on a 365-day period, another currency might be on a 360-day period. So the interest rates aren't exactly comparable, and there's different kind of methodologies in different currencies that are set. So, it's just something to be aware of, that there's a whole kind of little world in there of rules and ways that things are approached that make, not a huge difference, but a relevant enough difference to be aware of. Now, under these swap agreements, typically the arrangement will be that you receive a fixed payment that you've agreed to over a series of payments or periods, and you'll be paying some floating rate or rate with some other reference point. So you might say someone sells you a contract for 20 years, and every 6 months, for example, on that period, you might pay them 2.5% fixed, like a bond coupon. And what they'll do is they'll pay you the 2.5% fixed, and in return, you'll have a rate set with reference to a LIBOR reference point, and you'll pay them the funds on whatever they earn. So that might get reset simplistically every 180 days. It's set at, say, 4.2%. You'll work out how much you owe them for that period, and you'll exchange and net off the difference. So if you want to be in a position under these contracts to deliver your payments, you want to be generating on your underlying assets sufficient return that you can pay those. The other area in this market is you have something under these swap agreements that It works differently in different cases, but in effect, what you have to do is lodge collateral with the other party when under that agreement there's a negative value above a certain threshold. So you'll typically, one party might have an agreement and they start off and it's effectively priced around zero because rates haven't moved apart from the initial cost. So they haven't moved. A couple of days later, interest rates have dropped. So one party, in effect, has got something of value in the other party. If they were to go out of that position, would have a payment to have to pay an amount back. So you typically have this collateral that's lodged. Now, when that collateral is lodged, you have an obligation to pay an interest rate on that. And often, not always, because it can be indexed to anything that's agreed between the parties, that's indexed to overnight rates or the SONIA rate, because I may only need that collateral for a couple of days and then have to take it back because the value of the swap position has changed. So there's kind of an interaction between these different rates. And it may be that, you know, I have, let's say, £100 million of cash. I'm happy that I could put that aside earning LIBOR net after everything. But I find my swap position goes up and it's worth, say, £20 million. I'm given £20 million of collateral. And I've got an obligation to deal with that money and pay a certain rate on that, which is different to LIBOR. So I have to kind of deal with the collateral management as well. Now, you can have different structures of these contracts, but just to give you a feel of the interaction between the rates. So hopefully it will move on, yes. So just looking at this chart, there's a couple of things. The first is the time period that this current one is taken from is for calendar 2007. And there's a couple of different lines, and I'll just step through a couple of points on them. The first one is, I put it up to illustrate some items. It's not a very good direct comparison for some issues. So one of the particular areas is, if you take that dark blue line, which is SONIA, which is an overnight rate, that's the actual rate overnight. So if I'm at the same point, so say I'm sitting there at, if I pick a period, at March 07, and it's somewhere around the 5.75 mark. That's fine, that's the rate I earn there. If I step forward for the next 90 days, and go through April, May, and June, that whatever rate I would be looking at for a 90-day period at that point, I'm looking forward about the expectations. I'm not comparing it to what actually happened after the event in terms of the overnight market. So to see kind of where the pricing might vary, you would have to set a forward curve at each point on the overnight rate and then work your way back to saying, how did they actually compare to a spread on the 90-day rate, rather than look at what actually happened over the next 90 days to what would happen if I took a position at that point. So some of these kind of temporal issues just aren't clear from the graph. What I do want to point out is if we remove that issue and we start comparing some of the lines, there's some interesting issues that arise. So I'll come back to the green line, LIBOR 90, and this purple line or crimson line, repo 90. The repurchase rate is pretty close to a kind of gilt treasury note type rate. I mean, it's fairly close to that in the way we've presented it. And what you can see is up until about middle of the year, there was a very close correlation between the two. You can see, you know, the green line went up and down, the purple line went up and down. And I'm not saying, by the way, that the period before June were normal conditions long term. They just happened to be how it was. It tends to be correlated, but the spreads have moved around quite a lot. They used to be wider, they've come in and they've gone back out again. But the issue is, you know, it's pretty close, the movement. Once you come out to about August, September, you see that there's a pretty big divergence that starts to occur. The green line kind of goes up, you've got the crimson line starting to come down, and you have this spread opening up between the two. And that spread is something that probably didn't matter that much when it was close together. The kind of range of error you would get from thinking about the gap between the two probably doesn't matter as much when it's small, but when it opens up wide, it becomes much more important. If you look at the 7-day figures, which is the aqua line and the kind of lighter blue line, you can see again similarly fairly closely correlated, but as you move on they still stay pretty close. In other words, they don't have the same gap widening up. So there's an issue on term. So under a contract, if you structured it in terms of 7-day rates as a reference point rather than, say, 90-day rates or any other period, you have an impact here. You have kind of a difference in risk that's been exposed between how you could invest the money, the type of period that you run it over, and also just kind of the days you might roll over the money versus the days the market resets the rate. So there's just kind of some increasing basis risk that rolls out there. Looking at the next page, what we tend to do is we always kind of think about the recent past. So I brought this up until the end of March, and what you see is, again, a little bit of a closing gap between the LIBOR and the repo rate on 90 days, so the green line and the crimson line, but then it starts to widen out again, and you know it's close now to 100 basis points. So that's kind of gone from somewhere in that 20, 30 out to 100 over a period of a year and a half. Now, where you are in that gap matters quite a lot. So if I'm sitting there and trying to model something looking forward, you have to make some assumption about how those gaps may widen or narrow over that period to think about what are the right reference rates that you're looking at under those liabilities. And the challenge is that the green line has often been used automatically as a number of reference points for documents and for modelling that's been done. There's been a spread or margins or costs, but it probably wouldn't have been below that crimson line. So when they were close, you had a pretty tight range. Now we've got this much bigger decision to work out, you know, where that gap is. So we've kind of got these markets moving around a little bit. We're sitting there with our money saying, how do we invest it? We look there and say, well, we want to get something like LIBOR if we wanted to meet that kind of contract ambition, or LIBOR plus something, or LIBOR minus something. There's a couple of costs involved, some which one a person mentioned earlier. You know, you have spreads on these contracts. If you buy these contracts, you might buy them initially thinking your cash flows, you know exactly when everyone's going to die, but after a little while, people don't behave that way and you need to adjust them. You roll them in, roll them out. So, you know, you might think your current spread costs you something, but over a period of time, that will aggregate as you change the contracts occasionally. What we've got here are a kind of illustrative set of numbers on what you might get if you're extremely efficient. So these aren't necessarily rates you'll get in the market or something. These are just rates that we've looked at over a longer term period and thought, let's just give some guidance about what kind of level. But in each particular case, the numbers could be quite different because of contractual terms or the way you need to structure it. But looking at this, if you need LIBOR, for a start, you've probably got a spread if you wanted to invest at that level of risk because of the brokerage, so you've got the bid rate. You've got some investment management fees, typically, if you're a pension fund. And 5 basis points we've got there is extremely low compared to some of the products in the marketplace. You have to pay a custodian, and again, that depends very much on size. But I've just put in 2 basis points as a guidance. You've got this frictional cost of the collateral. You know, if you have a position where you have to lodge collateral across, then you have to be able to shift money in and out. It means you can't necessarily invest it for the period you're looking at. So you have this kind of slight frictional cost because part of the time, if you look at it, you may be the one who has to lodge it. And you've got some, as we talked about, some of the spreads on the original contracts. So you kind